Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Coming up later this hour, did you see the article in the Science Times about those monkeys? Who they gave really little food, and what happened to them? They lived a really long time. Would it work for humans, and could we stand it? That's coming up later in the hour, but right now, it's our 2006 election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Issue 27, should the military be privatized? Our military is shrinking. Since the end of the Cold War, the U.S. has reduced the size of the armed forces by 36%, and this is happening while military activity, like the war in Iraq, is increasing the need for personnel. As a result, the government has outsourced much of the job to private military contractors. In Iraq alone, about 50,000 private employees do everything from providing security to feeding the 130,000 official troops. So what are the effects of this trend in privatizing the business of war? And would it be any different under Democratic or Republican oversight? With me for this are two guests, Robert Young Pelton, author of a book called License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, published by Crown, and Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an association of private security contractors. Welcome both of you to WNYC. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Young Pelton, I'll start with you. Give us a sense, according to your research, of the scope of this. How much does the U.S. rely on private contractors in the military now?
Well, far too much. I spent 3 years on the ground from Afghanistan to Equatorial Guinea to Iraq, and what I discovered is that we've returned to the bad old days of the 60s, whereby we can hide operations and activities by outsourcing. We can use private corporations to do our dirty work. We can interrogate prisoners. We can search for bin Laden. We can defend our interests by using essentially mercenaries. Now, yes, many of these people are glorified security guards, but I document multiple cases in my book in which they've gone operational and they become part of our sort of foreign policy. Probably the single most disturbing event was in March 2004, where four private citizens were killed in Fallujah who were working for Blackwater. And instead of maintaining our hearts and minds campaign around the very dangerous city, we shifted to a very brutal tactic of destroying the city, all this because of four civilians who took a wrong turn.
But wait, would the U.S. reaction have been any different had they been four uniformed military personnel?
Well, on that same day, a number of Marines were actually killed within the same area. The bottom line is that because of the televised mutilation and massacre of these men,
and because they were identified as civilians, it had a different meaning in America. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I mean is that we had four American citizens who were not operating under the bounds of military law or conduct who made a mistake. And because of that mistake, our trajectory in Iraq was changed.
All right. Doug Brooks, you represent private military companies, if that's the right phrase. Do you see a trend toward privatization of the military? Give us a short history of this as you see it.
Well, I mean, if you go back to Vietnam, at one point we had 80,000 contractors working in support of the military. So it's not particularly new. It kind of, the number of contractors or the reliance on them goes up and down depending on the particular operation. Certainly what we have is a military that's more professional than it's ever been in the past. It's all volunteer. We basically want to use our military for very specific operations, and there's really no point in having combat soldiers, you know, wash latrines or things like that. That can be done by the private sector. But even on the security side, essentially, do you need to have the military, for example, protecting other corporations that are doing some of the reconstruction work, or can we outsource that? And I think we've seen that we can outsource it quite effectively.
What about the Fallujah incident that Mr. Pelton mentioned?
Well, I think you're right about that, and sensitive, you know, and I think he made kind of made the point as well that essentially it was an issue because it was a filmed event. And as he pointed out, I think it was four engineers, actually, Army engineers, who were actually killed the same day nearby, and that was not filmed, and so it didn't have the same impact in the U.S. as the Blackwater employees.
Do you?
Go ahead. Sorry?
Well, I was just going to ask, if you make a case that there are certain circumstances under which it's better to outsource military functions and ones in which it's better not to?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, essentially, the U.S. military says, you know, we will do offensive combat operations. So that's reserved for the U.S. military. And they have some very strict rules on what private security companies or other companies can do when there's a military offensive underway. Who they can guard and so on, and that's it's set out so that essentially the military has a very clear task, but it can outsource the sort of ancillary operations that are not related to the offensive combat operation.
So Robert Pelton, he says it's not that different even than in the Vietnam days, and he makes the case that it kind of makes sense to hire people as needed rather than keep a huge standing army all the time, which would cost the American taxpayers more money and have people sitting around doing things they didn't need to do.
Well, this is a fundamental problem. Doug is talking about things on paper. In reality, between 300 and 750 private contractors have been killed in Iraq. They are now part of the major targets of insurgents. We now go to war lockstep with corporations. So, yes, in a perfect world where nobody shot at anybody, it would be great to have corporate citizens and corporate entities in a war zone. But in actual fact, it's part of our combat operations. More importantly, when you look at how many people are in country, in Iraq right now, according to my figures, there are 70,000 hired guns. And these are half Iraqis, half expats. These people are there specifically to guard things, in other words, in a passive mode. And yet there are multiple instances of when they go aggressive, when they become part of the combat matrix. So it does end up with sort of the worst-case scenario.
This is 93.9 and AM 820, WNYC and WNYC.org. It's our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 27. How much should the military be privatized? There is a lot of outsourcing of functions going on in the war in Iraq, and my guests, Robert Young Pelton, author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an association of private security contractors. And we can take phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org with your comments or questions. Do you care about this? Does it matter to our national life, to our national security, to our national morals and ethics? Doug Brooks, one criticism of this use of private companies involves accountability, that anyone working for a private company is not subject to the same rules as the actual military personnel. It's just a business transaction, after all. And so how are private contractors treated differently than military personnel, for instance, when it comes to accusations of abuse? I understand that employees of one company, that CACI, were implicated in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, but weren't necessarily accountable under the same rules.
No, it's very different rules for civilians, and it's quite interesting. The military has the Universal Code of Military Justice, but the Supreme Court has made clear that you can't hold civilians under the same rule. So what the Congress passed was something called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which essentially says that a felony crime of any contractor working for the U.S. government, of any nationality, interestingly, can be brought back to the United States and tried. Now, it has not been enforced rigorously, and from an industry perspective, it would be helpful if it were. Essentially, we support that kind of accountability. Nevertheless, for anything less than the level of a felony, the companies usually fire the people and send them home, which is kind of ruthless, but you can't mess around in the middle of a conflict zone. I think it's also important to look at the sort of some of the early legacy of these companies and IPOA. I mean, our trade association, it's not just security companies, but all companies that operate in areas of conflict. Our original focus was on Africa, and it was a number of companies that were supporting peace operations and peacekeeping in places like Sierra Leone, Liberia, Congo, and so on. And then after 9/11, of course, many of these companies went to work in Afghanistan and Iraq and expanded their operations. I think we're probably going to see some new rules and regulations coming out of Iraq, which is something the industry supports.
Did you mean to say, though, that a civilian court can be as ruthless, you used the term ruthless, as a court martial?
Well, no. What I mean by that is essentially you get fired for doing a fairly minor infraction, something like an accidental discharge where your weapon goes off inadvertently at some time. Most security companies will get rid of you at that point. I mean, there's no – essentially they have to make sure that they follow their contract.
Corporate judgment. Well, let me follow up on that with a clip. President Bush was actually asked about this earlier this year. A student put him on the spot when he gave a speech at Johns Hopkins University. Let's listen to that exchange.
Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed applied to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I was going to pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it?
And from what I gather, Mr. Brooks, the Pentagon never answered an attempt to follow up on that question. Why won't the president or Rumsfeld answer those kinds of questions?
Well, I can't speak for the administration. But let me say this. The industry founded an organization in Baghdad called PSCAI, the Private Security Company Association of Iraq. And it actually, PSCAI's main function has been working with the Ministry of Interior and the Iraqi government to establish licenses, to establish rules for the private security companies and so on. And it's been something of an uphill battle, I mean, because of the changeover in governments and so on. But essentially, it's quite interesting because the industry's taken the lead on this. They work better under rules and regulations. The other thing I should point out, by the way, is that we count close between 5,000 and 8,000 non-Iraqis that are armed doing the security in Iraq, and then maybe 20,000 or 30,000 Iraqis that are working for Western companies. Now, the Iraqis, of course, are under Iraqi law. And the trend of all the companies, and no matter whether it's logistics or support or security, is to use as many Iraqis as possible, which just makes sense from an ethical, professional, and legal perspective.
Robert Pelton, you want to weigh in on this question of accountability?
Yeah, the thing that Doug is not mentioning is that, number one, it's a disaster. The Ministry of the Interior's attempts to register and control armed men in Iraq is, of course, a joke because of their own involvement in death squads. Over 3,000 members of the Ministry of the Interior were fired because of their activities. The privatization of violence is a direct result of this administration trying to hide its dirty laundry by going to the private sector. If you go back into the 60s to White Star in Laos, when we fought entire wars using contractors and mercenaries and proxy armies and corporations, that was deemed to be not the appropriate way to conduct foreign policy in the Church Pike Committee. What we have to do is find out exactly who these people are and what they're doing, and that's what I attempted to do in my book.
So where do private security personnel come in, you know, under international law, Mr. Pelton? How does the Geneva Convention treat them, for instance?
Well, they're mercenaries. It's as simple as that. Many countries like South Africa, for example, have branded the exportation of military skills as a mercenary activity, and they've passed laws to prevent it. Other countries like ourselves look at it as a very benign form of security, and in many cases it is. It's no different than the guy down at your local mall. But we have yet to define where the lines are, and I think Doug would agree that one of the things we have to do in what we call the war on terror is to look at what boundaries we're overstepping by using private corporations.
Mr. Brooks, you don't like that word mercenary, do you?
Well, here, there's no effective legal definition of the word, and the real definition of mercenary is foreigners or business people we don't like. And when you look at how it's used, that's really what it boils down to. So I think what we have to look at is, are individuals operating legally or illegally in the field? Are they, you know, committing mayhem, or are they actually, you know, enforcing laws and rules and regulations and so on?
Mr. Pelton?
Well, this is an argument that is yet to be discussed, because right now, when I was in the field in Iraq, I was with South African mercenaries who were working as security contractors. In the recent coup attempt in Equatorial Guinea, two of the men arrested on that plane were security contractors from Iraq who took a vacation to go buffalo hunting. One of the fellows on that plane, Raymond Stanley Archer, had just come from working for a security company deposing Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So the lines are very fuzzy between mercenary and contractor.
Well, I think you could be clear from a company perspective. It's easier to hold companies accountable. Essentially, they have financial backgrounds. They have to be based somewhere. I think it's important that the clients take care to see what companies are hiring. Are the companies ethical? Are they part of trade associations? I think that's important as well. But I think it's much easier to hold companies accountable. Ultimately, an individual, whether it's a journalist or somebody, ex-military person, can commit a crime, and they should be treated as criminals.
We'll continue in a minute with how much should the military be privatized, issue 27 in our 2006 election series, 30 issues in 30 days. We'll ask whether Democrats or Republicans would treat privatization any differently if the Democrats were to get into power. Would things change? And we'll see if we would need a draft if we weren't privatizing this much. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our 2006 election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Coming up in this series tomorrow, issue 28, are all politics national in 2006? Thursday, issue 29, polarized America. Is there any other way? And we conclude Friday with issue 30, the median wage, or is the American middle class dying? We continue now with issue 27, outsourcing the war, Pentagon contracting and its consequences, with Robert Young Pelton, author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an association of private security contractors. And let's take a phone call. Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, Brian. I wanted to ask a question. Representative Rangel had introduced a bill possibly bringing back the draft about a year or so ago. Senator McCain had talked about possibly increasing the American presence in Iraq. How do the private contractors fit into that equation? And if they were eliminated completely, would that possibly bring up a need to either reinstitute a draft, or what would be the consequences of eliminating these people?
Robert Pelton, want to take that?
Yes, this is an excellent question. Number one, it's my opinion after doing my research is that the Bush administration is deliberately going to the private sector to show up the lack of military capability and also to sidestep some of the more dramatic issues that people want answers to. In other words, you know, what are we doing in Iraq? Why are people dying there? Now, this is a topic that will be with any political party. The privatization of the military and even intelligence forces is with us for good. So the first step is to find out the extent, and I think that's what we need to do.
Mr. Brooks?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with Robert on this. But I think it's important to remember that essentially 95% of the contractors we're talking about are unarmed support contractors. So if you did increase the size of the military, the number of contractors would increase as well. But I think it's important to keep in mind, as much as we've outsourced a lot of support for our military, this is probably the best supported supplied military in history. So it has there's a reason they are doing this, and it's now being the concept is being copied in the UK and Canada as well, and probably any military, any Western military that plans to be relevant outside of its national borders is going to be working with private contractors and to support them.
Russell in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Russell.
Thank you, Brian. The question I have is about Alan Grayson in Florida and his campaign to bring cases against some of these private contractors who are have had people blowing the whistle on them to the tune of tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in Iraq. And the law says that, you know, the president is supposed to make a decision whether to join cases brought under the False Claims Act within 60 days. And so far, although there's been dozens of cases that Alan Grayson has brought to the public's eye, the president has only talked about one of them, which resulted in March in a $10 million award.
And of course, there have been lots lots of charges regarding, you know, the results of no bid contracts and the overcharging and the ties that one of the major companies, Kellogg Brown and Root, has to Vice President Dick Cheney. KBR is a subsidiary of Halliburton, of which Cheney was CEO. Robert Young-Pelton, are you familiar with the issue that the caller raises about the president's involvement? And what can you tell us about the awarding of contracts and all this overcharging that we've heard about?
Well, let me focus on two things. One is that Halliburton is an infrastructure supplier to the U.S. military, and obviously people like Cheney and Bush come out of an industry, which is the oil industry, an infrastructure industry, where it's just normal to outsource what they call surge needs. In other words, if you have a huge demand for something, you don't ramp up the military, you just write a check. So that is one problem. The second thing is that when we go to investigate these contracts, we do have visibility and accountability on some of the more mundane infrastructure contracts that Halliburton and KBR provide. So I think it's healthy that we're trying to investigate misuse, overcharging, whatever. My focus is really on the trigger pullers, the people who deal in privatized violence, and that's where we have absolutely no oversight and no accountability.
Mr. Brooks?
I think it's one reason we have trade associations is to get the high-end players or the better companies under umbrellas and hopefully squeeze out the companies, the bottom feeders, as we call them, that aren't doing such a good job. There's essentially three major associations that are working in Iraq. Aside from IPOA, we have the Private Security Company Association of Iraq that I mentioned, and also the British Association of Private Security Companies. And we've all been working together on a number of issues to make sure the companies operate to a higher level.
Well, then let me get your reaction to the report released last week by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, who said more than half the budget of some reconstruction projects in Iraq went on overhead costs like housing employees and administrative tasks rather than actual construction. How do you answer to those charges of waste and abuse?
I think there's been some big problems. I mean, when you try and do reconstruction in the middle of a war, when deconstruction is still well underway, it gets very expensive, and I think it's a very difficult situation. A lot of the money's going towards hardening the targets, that we're building a lot of concrete around these things. When you go to Iraq or if you go to Kabul, you'll see a lot of large concrete walls set up to protect these things against blasts and so on. And you have to protect the employees. And then there's an issue of...
So you're saying these are not overcharges or examples of waste? These are just
sure
the necessary costs of doing business, of reconstruction in a war zone?
There sure may be some. I mean, there's enough money flowing around. I'm sure there will be some. And I think companies that are guilty of that need to pay the price.
Maybe some, I think, is an understatement. I think that the Iraq war is one of the biggest fleecings of the American taxpayers in recent history. When we put a dollar into the reconstruction, it doesn't go directly to the ground. It's sliced off by multiple layers of subcontractors. When I was in Iraq in July, an example of the security cost, we had to have armed convoys to bring gravel to a police station in Taramiya, and then we knew that when this police station would be built, it would be blown up within 30 to 60 days. So it's not just the waste, it's the futility of what we're doing.
Coming up in 10 minutes, we will look at that story in the Science Times today about the severely restricted diet fed to some experimental monkeys who then wound up living a really long time. Should we try the same things on ourselves, and could we stand it? But we continue right now with our 2006 election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days on WNYC, Issue 27. How much should the military be privatized? Is the Iraq War being privatized too much? With Robert Young-Pelton, author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, published by Crown, and Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an association of private security contractors. And here's an email related to what we were just talking about. The listener says, please ask your guests about the article yesterday showing thousands of weapons not registered by the U.S. Army, as well as stolen Iraqi and Iraqi police and military uniforms aiding the death squads in the war there. Mr. Pelton, is this in your area?
Yeah, one of the things that you have to temper that with is that there's loss and corruption in all large endeavors. The 10% number is not that bad. But one interesting thing is by privatizing the training of the police and the military, we've created essentially polarized groups of armed men who have been trained by us. So we have Shia groups, Kurdish groups, Sunni groups, and then those people then graduate onwards to be part of the militia. So if you were to go to the MOI and have a tea with one of the people that works there, you'd find out that he carries two ID cards, one for the Sadr militia and one for the Ministry of the Interior. So we have no oversight and no clear idea of what this massive privatization of hiring and training Iraqis has done to the political situation.
Actually, if I could weigh in on that, I think one of the number one complaints of our companies when they were working in Iraq was the need for better oversight from the government. It was hard for the good companies to make the case that they were doing a better job than the less good companies if there's not enough contract officers. And so one of the issues was, let's get enough contractors over there, and if you're going to outsource, you just have to do the oversight. So one something we've been pushing for as an industry association is to make sure there's more effective government oversight.
Well, I agree with that, Doug. One of the things that I have been calling for is, let's get these companies in front of Congress under oath, and let's find out what they do, how they do it, and let's separate the wheat from the chaff, as it were, because there are good companies doing good things, and there are lousy companies doing lousy things.
Clay in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Hi, my question is really with regard to, why is it that the U.S. government is keeping the total number of contractors and their casualty rates such a secret?
Could I answer that?
When a private corporation does business in Iraq, the only way you're going to find out if there was a death involved is through the Defense Base Act insurance program, where they have to actually claim for insurance. There's a guy that works out of his kitchen, does iCasualties.org. He estimates about 350 or so, depending on who you believe, but there are no accurate numbers. But
Mr. Brooks, why doesn't your association, which represents these companies, release that information?
We don't have it. Essentially, you have hundreds of government organizations, maybe, that are hiring security for one reason or another, or contractors for one reason or another, and you have contractors coming in and going out. The Government Accountability Office actually called for the Department of Defense to keep a database of contractors going in and out of Iraq, which they have not been able to do up till now, as far as I know. This is something that actually IPOA is looking at doing. We may be able to do a better job of keeping track of contractors, but I think it would be worthwhile.
Okay, officially only 7 U.S. military contractors have died, and that's a farce.
I think is that 7 government employees or
right? That's the official terms. But for example,
yeah, but I think it's government employees.
There are more contractors working for the CIA looking for Bin Laden than there are full-time employees. It is a terribly underreported activity.
I could be wrong, but I think that specific number was about actual government employees of DOD.
Correct, contractors.
Yeah, right.
So this is because of the nature of politics right now, with Republicans in charge and Republicans making the decisions about this outsourcing during the war, Democrats are the ones most loudly denouncing it. Mr. Pelton, do you have any reason to believe things would be different if the Democrats took control of Congress?
Yes, very much so, because I've been asked to go in front of the policy folks and lay out what I've discovered in my 3 years of being on the ground. I seem to be singular and alone in my endeavors to investigate this. More importantly, there are very negative repercussions caused by privatization that have yet to be defined. Secondly, or thirdly, there are actually positive things that privatization can do. But because the American public is not aware of this issue, we don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing yet.
Right. Well, Congressman Henry Waxman, the California Democrat, would be the chair of the House Oversight Committee if control changes, and he's been extremely critical on these issues. Mr. Brooks, how much do you see that as a threatening change?
Well, if I can be fully transparent here, I'm a registered Democrat. I used to work for the Democratic Party, and I think the reality is even when the Democrats control things, they use private companies as well. I think we'll see these private companies will continue to be used. I think it won't necessarily be bad that we actually have a different party controlling at least one house in Congress, and in the sense that we will get better oversight, which I think from the perspective of the high-end companies that are members of IPOA, that's a good thing.
If we're going to be transparent, could you name the one person who's not allowed to be a member of your organization who has the largest single security contract in Iraq right now?
Well, we have we're a membership of companies, and so we have essentially we don't individuals can't join. I mean, we have something called the Friends of IPOA. If you want to go,
I hear tap dancing. You're talking about Aegis Defense Systems. We're not allowed 3 times to join your organization. Why?
Sorry?
He's asking you why that Aegis Defense Systems was not allowed on 3 occasions to join your organization. Why?
Well, I can't talk about exactly why companies are members or not members, or why they choose to be members or choose not to be members.
I hear tap dancing.
Up to the company.
All right. Mr. Pelton, you seem to...
Can I answer this question?
Go ahead.
When I was in the field, I talked to a lot of companies about them, and they were doing a fine job. I don't think anybody had a problem with them in Iraq that I could find.
Mr. Pelton, what's there?
Now, the truth is that the members of Doug's organization did not want Aegis to join because it's a company run by a former mercenary named Tim Spicer. And if you remember the fiasco on the Internet with the Aegis trophy videos, and if you remember Sandline's activities in which Tim Spicer was president of in both Sierra Leone and Bougainville or Papua New Guinea, he is the worst-case scenario. And he has the largest single security contract in Iraq right now.
So does that indicate that Mr. Brooks' organization has some standards, but that the government
doesn't? And unfortunately, he won't come clean about what those standards are.
But the government is
for standards.
But the government is.
If you go to the website, we have a code of conduct online. Any member that joins up has to agree to abide by that code of conduct. But at the same time, I think we have to push the standards industry wide. The Aegis is part of the BAPSC, the British Association of Private Security Companies, and actually I'm talking from the UK, where they're actually having a conference looking at the regulation of the industry, the aggressive self-regulation that they're putting into, and possibly an ombudsman from the British side, which all makes sense, and Aegis is part of that.
Mr. Belton, Aegis
was roundly criticized by Democratic senators, the Irish Mafia, if you want to call it that, and yet they still got their contract. So I encourage Doug to tighten up those restrictions, but I also encourage him to be more transparent.
So, Mr. Pelton, if there are so many problems with private contractors, what's the alternative, a larger military?
Yes, the alternative is to have a military that's fully accountable. When we go into a war situation and we realize that we're undermanned and we underestimate the task ahead of us, we have to go to the American public and be honest about it. We can't go through the side door and hire private mercenaries to take care of our dirty business. And I want to make one thing clear, that when we talk about mercenaries or contractors, we're not talking about all Americans. We're talking about people from third world countries around the world who are doing our dirty work for minimum wage.
So can you see that changing under Democratic control, that is, willingness to expand the military?
No, what I see is a more accurate view of what kind of trouble we've got ourselves into in Iraq. It is one thing to say that we have 140,000 troops there. It's another thing to realize that it really requires 200,000 people, and that is something that is yet to be discussed in Congress or in any future plans on Iraq.
Mr. Brooks, here's another email. This one asks, the guys on the ground in uniform are dying, and the freelance are getting paid five times what the grunt gets, and the freelance can leave any time they want. Is that right?
It's accurate in the sense that when you hire somebody to voluntarily go and work in one of these areas, and whether they're cleaning toilets or doing security, essentially they're taking a greater risk. It's similar to if you hire somebody to do coal mining. You want somebody who knows what they're doing and knows how to handle the risks, but you're also going to pay them additional funds because they are going to take that greater risk. Anytime you send somebody into an area of conflict, especially when it's a voluntary thing and they're not in the military, then yes, you do have to pay them additional funds. But keep in mind, all these people that serve in these militaries are in these in the private companies are essentially former military people themselves. In some cases, 10, 20, 30 years in the military before they go into the private sector.
So
yeah,
which
military, Doug? I mean, when you want to eat in the chow hall in the green zone, you have to go through Nepalese. When you want to go to the press office, you have to speak Spanish to Colombians.
No, absolutely. It's the most global industry on earth, I think. And just when you meet somebody from a company in the field, whether it's Kabul or Baghdad or Sierra Leone or Kinshasa, essentially, you know, whatever their nationality is may have no reflection on where the company's actually based.
What about the implications for the taxpayer of that? If they get paid better in the private companies and the government is paying for that, then we're paying more for those soldiers than for our uniformed ones.
Well, there's a level of efficiency when you bring in specialists, especially in areas like engineering or the support areas. But when you talk about security contractors, essentially the cost of the U.S. right now for essentially every soldier we have in Iraq is something like $15,000 and $25,000 per month. So it's a lot of money. We provide a lot of support for our military. And essentially, conceivably, or at least theoretically, your second lieutenant can pick up his phone and call in a B-52 airstrike. That's a lot of capability, but it's very expensive. Private security companies don't have that capability, so they actually save you money in the long run.
We're just about out of time. Did I hear laughter?
Yeah, We're basically hiring mercenaries to carry out our foreign policy. There's something deeply wrong with that.
It's easy to sensationalize this issue and exaggerate the numbers and try and sell books, but I think we have to be realistic about what these companies are doing and what they can't do, and I think we have to look at the value it brings to the taxpayers. And I think the number one question is
I've been in wars on front lines with contractors. I'm not sensationalizing. A mercenary is a mercenary.
When you start throwing out the numbers and throwing out terminology like that, I think you are, yes.
We are just about out of time with Robert Young Pelton, author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an association of private security contractors. But I'm just curious, Mr. Pelton, private companies have not orchestrated actual military campaigns up to now, as far as I know. But can you see this happening? I read a senior executive of one of the biggest companies, Blackwater USA, quoted saying he would like to take on the Darfur account.
Right. He actually sent in a proposal under Colin Powell, and it was turned down. Eric Prince has a 1,700-man unit ready to go with air capability, gunships, fighter bombers that can drop JDAMs or cluster bombs. This is directly out of their brochure.
This is getting to the sensationalization aspect, but I think
this is directly out of Blackwater's PowerPoint presentation. I'm not making this up. The bottom line is he's ready to rock and roll anywhere in the world that the U.S. wants him to be.
Mr. Brooks, take the last word.
Companies have offered to do humanitarian security in Darfur, and I think it'd be something.
Cluster bombs are very humanitarian, Doug.
Doug Brooks, Robert Young Pelton, we're going to leave it there. Thank you both very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's 30 issues in 30 days for today. Let other media wallow in the polls and the attack ads. We've got issues, and we know you do too. Tomorrow, issue 28, Are All Politics National in 2006? And coming up in a minute, if we ate as little as these monkeys we're about to hear about, we might live to 110. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.